Hello all, welcome to History's Great Mysteries, and I thank you all for joining me today. I'm your host, Nick, and today I have a very special podcast for you guys on a subject that I've been following for quite a while now. I feel like most people I talk to believe that life exists beyond planet Earth. In the ever-expanding universe, the chances are astronomical that we are the only form of intelligent life. Still, there are some that refuse to subscribe to this belief, but I would confidently say that almost everyone wants the truth, one way or another. Everybody wants the truth, at least, until they have it. Then all they want to do is deny it. So, I'm going to ask you all to do me a favor during this episode. If you can keep an open mind to the possibilities, the story I'll tell you today is perhaps the most compelling piece of information we have ever gotten as humans, that extraterrestrial life does indeed exist. Of course, we've all heard about the infamous Area 51, a top-secret military base where the limits of our imagination run wild, considering what could possibly be going on behind those closed doors. Now, the people who work behind those closed doors are sworn to secrecy, but what if I told you that there was an individual who worked there, who saw it all, and then spilled the secrets to the public in order to protect himself? This is the incredible story of Bob Lazar. Now, before I dive into this episode, let me just preface by saying that a lot of what I say in this episode, like I was just about to tell you about when he was born and where he was born and all this stuff, a lot of it is just based on what he tells the public. So keep that in mind, is that a lot of times I'll be saying Lazar says or Lazar claims, and that's just saying the only way that I know this is by him saying it. And the whole source of controversy in this story is the fact that some people don't believe Lazar and some do. So just keep that in mind as I go about telling information. And then when I have information that is factual beyond Lazar's word, I will make that known as well. So anyways, Bob Lazar was born on January 26, 1959 in Coral Gables, Florida. Not much is reported about his upbringing until he attends Los Angeles Pierce College, taking courses in electronics. As his story goes, what happens next is that he receives a master's degree in physics from MIT and then a subsequent degree in electronic technology from Caltech. Soon thereafter, he secures a job at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Now, in the world of scientific study, Los Alamos is a really big deal. This lab is on the cutting edge of technological and scientific research, and is actually the place that is credited with the creation of the original atomic bombs used in World War II. Now, while working as a physicist at this facility in 1982, Lazar makes literal front page news for pulling off quite an incredible stunt. He reportedly replaced the engine of his Honda car with a straight up jet engine and proceeded to create a 200 mile per hour capable automobile that he drove around on the streets in New Mexico. This article in the paper got the attention of a man by the name of Ed Teller, a theoretical physicist referred to as the father of the hydrogen bomb. Lazar and Teller made a connection at this time regarding the news article in the car, and years later, after Lazar had left his position at Los Alamos, he moved to Las Vegas and began the process of re-entering the work field. He actually remembered his connection with Edward Teller and sent a resume over to him, which he believes is the reason he was offered a job at the then top secret Area 51. The job was originally offered to him as important government research in the area of propulsion that will take place in a remote area of Nevada with very odd hours. Lazar, obviously, ended up accepting this mysterious job offer, and the next thing he knows, he's flown out to the secret airbase, being thoroughly vetted and informed about the top secret research that he will be conducting. Now, to be clear, Lazar claims that he didn't actually work physically on Area 51, but a subbase of Area 51, a facility called S4 that is around 15 miles south. Of course, it is in these first few days that Lazar invariably signed multiple kinds of non-disclosure agreements to keep his lips shut about anything and everything that he sees while working. And I'm talking like he can't even confide in his closest friends, in his wife, nothing. He literally, he's told he has to lie to them about what he's doing. He can't write it down in a diary, nothing. And obviously, he did not hold up this agreement, which is exactly why we are talking about him right now. Also in these first few days, Lazar begins to be introduced to the strange research that's going on at S4. And he didn't really understand what was going to happen when he took this job. He didn't really know exactly what kind of research he was going to be doing. And like I said, it was in these first few days where some strange things started happening, and then he fully got a grasp on what he's doing. And this is kind of where I will officially introduce you guys to the absolutely incredible and life-altering claims, if they are true. Now, the nature of his job at this facility was interesting. He claims that there were many people working there, and everybody was in charge of a different part of the research. So there's a whole overarching research about this alien technology, but teams are dedicated to, okay, so we're the team that's looking at materials, we're the team that's looking at controls. Him and his team, it was a two-person team with a partner that he refers to as Barry, were in charge of looking at power and propulsion. So that's why he was hired there, to kind of have this wild mind, young Lazar who, strapped a jet engine to his Honda. That they wanted kind of an outside perspective, and clearly they had had a lot of people working over the years trying to reverse engineer this technology. So that's what he's told when he walks in. They tell him that you and Barry are in charge of reverse engineering this reactor, and then they hand him this reactor that was reportedly lifted off of a technologically advanced alien ship. So everybody there is working on what he understands as recovered alien technology. And when it comes to propulsion and this reactor, he's in charge of looking at, and they can turn it on, is what he says. They can turn on this reactor, and he's in charge of trying to reverse engineer and understand how this reactor works. Now, when he looks at this reactor, he initially says, okay, it's basketball sized, and when it's turned on, it can produce an anti-gravity field, which essentially is exactly, if you can understand gravity, it's pulling things down, pulling things towards the center of gravity. This thing is pushing things away, so it's anti-gravity. So when he tries to touch this basketball-shaped reactor, he can't actually get his hand close enough to touch it. That's the nature of the anti-gravity that he claims. And this is incredible to Lazar, and this is when he realizes, like, what we're dealing with is clearly not man-made, and we are not even close to this type of technology, because this little reactor is actually creating and manipulating gravity, and that in and of itself is insane to Lazar. And everything that we know about gravity, we can't create gravity. We can't manipulate gravity. Gravity is the result of large, large amounts of mass. That's the reason that there's gravity around the sun, gravity around the earth. Huge amounts of mass is the only thing that we know that creates gravity. And this little basketball-shaped reactor is actively creating and manipulating gravity, which he says is how it managed to propel the alien ship that it was once attached to. Now, what he says is that, and you have to follow me here, and I had to brush up on my physics here to be able to explain this in any kind of way that makes sense. But essentially, what he believes is that when it was in the alien spaceship, it would manipulate gravity in front of the spaceship and essentially bend space so that this spaceship is rolling through space. So if you can imagine, essentially, like, you have your bed and you put a bowling ball on your bed, and you put your fist in front of the bowling ball, and then obviously the bowling ball is going to roll towards your fist because you've just created a bend in the space that the ball is lying on. That's essentially how this ship, as he believes it, is moving through space. It's bending gravity in front of it to enable it to cross insane distances in nothing at all time. Now, obviously, they had very little success actually understanding what and how this thing works. They could see it. They could turn it on, and they could see it working. But they through their time there, he says that they almost made no progress trying to actually understand how to replicate it. And he actually has a really good quote in an interview he did where he talks about and he makes an analogy on trying to replicate this alien technology, and I'll play it for you.
We really have no idea what we're talking about. And the excitement kind of turned to dread at some point because the amount of power we're dealing with is astronomical. I mean, to affect gravity, to produce the effects like this equipment does, takes huge amounts of power. And I've given the example before of, you know, taking a small portable nuclear reactor and, you know, putting it back into Victorian times, you know, with the scientists of the time, and just dropping it in a room. And they come and look at it and see that it's producing power and wonder how it works. So they start taking it apart. And as soon as they get some of the shielding off, the people are going to drop dead because of the radiation inside. Now, the people have no idea that radiation even exists back then. But anybody that comes in to check on them will also drop dead. And, you know, there's no reason that that exact scenario couldn't happen with what we're dealing with.
This part of the story is absolutely crazy to me, and I really wish that he could have gathered more. If he is telling the truth, I wish that he could have gathered more information in his time there. But as he puts it, when he was working there, everything is very secretive and compartmentalized, meaning that no one else talked to anybody else about the research that they were doing. So imagine all the other things that people are looking at and discovering about this incredible technology that is unfathomable almost to us as humans. And considering all this, it's just already completely bizarre, and the story is incredible, but it would only continue to get more so. As Lazar spent more time working at this secret facility, he eventually began to peek at more activities beyond his specific task. Now, it was very restricted as to what he could look at, and he had to prove that it was going to be advantageous to his research for him to look at something else. So he actually talks about one instance where he convinced his superiors that he should be allowed to physically enter the spacecraft that they lifted the reactor from. He claimed that, I want to see where it sat and perhaps how it interacted with its environment around it. Maybe that'll help me understand it. So they allow it, and they send him into this hangar. And he says that as he was walking to this hangar, there were actually 9 other hangars that were down this mountainside at the S4 facility that each contained separate craft of different sizes and different shapes and different looks, which meant, I don't want to, you know, jump the gun on what this means essentially, but in my mind, this means that there's several different occasions in which they recovered a craft, essentially, if what he's saying is true. Now, he goes up to one of these hangars and goes into one of the crafts that is the craft that they lifted his reactor from. Now, inside this craft, he immediately points out how strange everything looks. And how he puts it is that there's nothing on this craft that you or I as humans would recognize immediately. There's no, okay, that's a window. Okay, that's a door over there. Oh, okay, that's a bathroom over there. No, like, everything is just bizarre. And nothing really makes sense. Furthermore, there's no straight lines or edges anywhere, which is not how our modern world is designed at all. Everything is straight lines. He says that inside it was only curved lines that led to other curves in a very sleek and smooth design manner on the inside. Furthermore, there's no buttons, no screens, no paintings or decorations, nothing. Just a very sleek, bare bones interior to this aircraft. Now, he doesn't know if maybe it was always that way. Have they taken things out? Who knows? But while inside this aircraft, he also notices that it's clearly meant for something or someone or a creature that's smaller than he is. So he's almost 6 feet tall, and he says that it's probably for a creature that's around half his size, just based on the environment that he's in. Now, another spectacular claim that was made by Lazar centered around what he actually discovered while working on the reactor. Specifically, he says that what powered the reactor was element 115. Now, what's so special about Element 115, you may ask? Well, at the time when Bob purports to be working at Area 51, Element 115 had not yet been discovered. It would be until 2003 that a joint team of US and Russian scientists were able to synthesize the extremely radioactive element in a lab and named it Muscovium. Even so, the most stable known isotope of this element, Muscovium-290, only has a half-life of about 0.65 seconds, meaning that it decays very quickly and it's incredibly unstable. And again, I had to brush up on my chemistry as well to be able to report this back to you guys. But anyways, what Lazar reports is that the element 115 that was inside his reactor was actually stable and didn't decay. And it is this stable 115 that allowed for, in some way, he didn't understand this part, but it was this stable 115 that allowed for the creation and manipulation of gravity. On several occasions, Lazar states that he was allowed to watch the craft actually take part in test flights with the reactor inside of it. And he again purported, like, I need to see this to be able to understand how it moves, how it works. So on several occasions, he said that he watched this craft fly and do test flight maneuvers, hovering reportedly just a few feet off of the ground, silently zooming back and forth in the air, to the likes of which Lazar had never seen before, in any kind of man-made aircraft at least, right? In a man-made aircraft, we have a very one-dimensional flight pattern where you have to propel yourself with combustion through the air in one direction and make slow turns back and forth if you want to have any kind of turning and maneuvering in the air. Not with this craft. It apparently was just moving back and forth, up and down, silently, without agreeing with the laws of inertia or physics. It seemed like something out of like the X-Files, right? It didn't seem like it belonged in reality, as Lazar puts it. Apparently, the spectacular manner of the flight of this alien craft was so incredible to Lazar that he just couldn't keep it to himself. This is where I'll get into the downfall of him working at the secret military base. At some point, Bob Lazar became aware of the schedule for these secret test flights of the alien aircraft. He knew that some test flights and maneuvers were scheduled on specific times, on specific nights, at Papoose Lake, which is a dry lake bed where he says that they conducted these test flights. So 3 weeks in a row, Bob Lazar secretly took his wife and two close friends, Gene Huff and John Lear, out to see these test flights firsthand. Looking back, Lazar says that it was an obviously stupid decision on his part, but again, at this point, he's still in his 20s, and I mean, when they did this, they were bringing coolers of beer and food out, and it would just became like literally a viewing party. And on one of these occurrences, the group took live home videos of the Endeavor. Now, the test flights on these occasions took place at night, meaning that the video clips we have prove very little. All we can really see is a bright light moving back and forth across a black sky, and no details can really be made out at all. I will, however, play you some interesting dialogue between the friends on one of those nights.
This is John Lear, and today is March 22nd, 1989. We're standing just about 8 miles due east of Groom Lake, Nevada, the super government secret test site. And just a few minutes ago, we saw one of the government extraterrestrial UFOs fly over there. We all watched it for about 7 or 8 minutes. Right here, I have my Celestron scope. It's 8 inches. And I had it focused in for about 15 seconds and saw for myself that, in fact, it was a disc. We're going to stay here for another couple hours here to see if we can show you folks an actual extraterrestrial flying saucer being flown by the government. So if you just stand by, and we'll be looking over that mountain, which is where they are. They also come over here, which is over at Bald Mountain. There's some lights over there which you can't see, but there are a number of trucks. We don't know whether they're looking down here or what they're doing up there, but we managed to get in here. We're standing on public land. It's completely legal where we are. And if you'd like to come here later in the show, we'll tell you exactly how to get here.
Right, you can mention who's with you, John.
We have Bob Lazar, and we have Jackie Lazar, Bob's wife, and we have Gene Huff. And this mission was organized tonight by Bob Lazar, who is a theoretical physicist who works at Groom Lake.
And is also a dead man at this
point. As a side note, the man that was talking in that interview is actually a man by the name of John Lear, who's a very experienced pilot who actually worked for the U.S. government in many capacities dealing with aircraft and piloting, to the point where I believe that maybe Bob Lazar took him out there to see what he thought about these aircraft moving through the sky in a manner that was never before seen by anything man-made. So anyways, when these group members were separately interviewed after the fact, they told the exact same story of what occurred on those nights. This part of Bob Lazar's tale stands as one of the most convincing forms of proof that he is indeed telling the truth of his involvement at Area 51. How did he know the schedule of these test flights? How did he know where exactly to go? And how did he know exactly what they would see? I've been trying to come up personally with logical explanation as to how he would have had this information without working there, and I honestly can't. The only thing, and it's extremely outlandish, the only thing that I can believe is that maybe he was like camping up on a desert mountain overlooking Papoose Lake day and night, trying to like write down their test flight schedules and whenever he saw something strange. But again, these took place at night, so he would have had to been there at night. He was living in Las Vegas at this time with his wife in a house. Like, I don't think this is a reasonable explanation as to how he knew these things. And another interesting point I'd like to get into about his wife is that, according to Lazar, while he was working at the facility, his superiors must have had his house or his phones bugged because they became aware that his wife was actually cheating on him, while Lazar didn't have any idea. And this actually prompted his superiors to then closely monitor Lazar every day to the point of actually having him followed, so that they could ensure the government's secrets remained in place when this bomb in their marriage decided to explode. The close monitoring of his actions actually scared Lazar, which he says is one of the main reasons he began to confide in his friends about what he was really doing at Groom Lake and why he brought them out there to see these secret test flights in the first place, to prove it to them. It was on the third week of bringing his friends out that all hell broke loose. Lazar remembers having a conversation with his friend Gene Huff, staring off into the black night, when he sees a green light from a night vision scope hit the ground only several yards in front of them, and this night vision scope actually belonged to an Area 51 guard who was watching and listening in on this viewing party. The next day, Lazar is flown out to a separate facility where he is interviewed and debriefed on the monumental amount of trouble that he's in. This is when they also inform him of his wife's infidelity, and I believe at this point both Lazar and the government agents come to the conclusion that Lazar will never resume working at Area 51 ever again. However, he wasn't immediately arrested and actually went home that night. He figures this is because he believes that his employers didn't really know how to handle the situation either. So while they're trying to figure out what to do about Bob Lazar, he is getting increasingly and increasingly anxious about their options. So anxious, in fact, that he actually begins to fear for his life. It is at this point that Lazar decides to contact an investigative reporter by the name of George Knapp, who operates in the Las Vegas area. George Knapp is actually a big player in this story, so he will get continually more important as I continue on here. But anyways, Knapp was understandably initially very skeptical of Lazar's incredible story, but as Knapp continued to dissect his claims under a microscope and he actually went out to corroborate his story with other people that would talk to him, Knapp eventually became convinced. In May of 1989, Lazar first sat in front of a television camera to broadcast his claims to the world. In this initial interview, Lazar's face was hidden and he went by the pseudonym Dennis. 8 months later, on November 10th, Lazar sat down again with George Knapp, this time with face and name fully revealed on a full-length special for KLAS-TV in Las Vegas. This interview is really what spurred the ensuing public frenzy around this, around his story. It was this story that really began the Area 51 frenzy that we are so familiar with today, actually, because before that interview, the only people that even knew the name Area 51 or S4 were the people who worked there. Even more so, almost no one was speculating that top-secret alien research was taking place there. Lazar talks about how he pushed for these two interviews because he truly feared for his life. He figured that if he came out on television and exposed everything, it would give him a sort of safety blanket because, after all, if he suddenly disappears off the face of the earth after making these claims, everyone will know that he must have been telling the truth and that our government is to blame. Since that time, Lazar has tried to lay low, relatively, under the radar, while the world around him continues to scrutinize and analyze the validity of his claims. Today, Lazar is 61 years old, and he owns and operates United Nuclear Scientific Equipment and Supplies. Only recently, around 2018, did Lazar kind of enter back into the limelight with the creation of a Netflix documentary called Bob Lazar, Area 51 and Flying Saucers, which is great. You guys should go watch it. While also appearing on several recent interviews where he continues to make the same exact claims that he made over 30 years ago. But how much of this can honestly be believed? Is it possible that it's all an elaborate hoax orchestrated by Lazar to gain fame? Or even more terrifying yet, is it possible that what he's saying is all true? I will now take a look at the explanations from popular skeptics and believers, as well as my own opinion on what we can possibly take away from the mystical legend that is Robert Lazar. So there are many people, obviously, that believe nothing of what he says, and it's all a hoax. There are many people that believe everything that he says, and it's all true. And then there are even some people that maybe lie somewhere in the middle, and they believe some things and not others. So it's really important to look at some of the points that are made by both sides and some of the counterpoints that are also made. So first, maybe some of you have been thinking, okay, did he ever take a polygraph test? And yes, he did. He's taken two, at least two that are on record. The first one came back inconclusive, and the second test came back as a pass with no deception detected. However, as many of you know, polygraphs are not the end-all be-all of truth. In fact, a polygraph is only able to detect fear and anxiety, and there are many reasons that you can end up with a false negative or a false positive. All it tells us is that on the second test, Lazar answered questions about his claims with no measurable amount of fear or anxiety while giving the answers. Okay, so here's another point that people make. How could element 115 occur naturally on a planet in the Zeta Reticulus star system? So the Zeta Reticulus star system is special because in Bob Lazar's briefings that he read when he first began this job that he purports, is that he was told the alien spacecraft came from a planet in this specific star system, Zeta Reticuli. And people who look at his element 115 claim and they say, okay, well then what you're saying is that there's stable element 115 in the Zeta Reticuli star system. And physically, as we understand space and physics around us, that isn't possible because stars will actually go through phases where they're creating different elements at their core, and when they hit the element of iron, they actually will implode. There'll be a supernova or a nova, and this is the end of the star. So at no point is there any creation of such a heavy element like 115. So as we understand the world, you know, quotes on that, as we understand it, it doesn't sound possible. Bob actually likes to counter this point himself by saying that a lot of the briefings that he was given when he first began at Area 51, he believes to actually be intentionally misleading. And another way to say this is that they actually would put straight up lies into his paperwork to essentially track information leaks. So what this means is that they'll put specific information in each employee's debriefings. And if something was to leak, say, oh my gosh, all these aliens are coming from the Zeta Reticuli star system, then they know exactly who leaked this information because they know that they only put it into one person's paperwork. And that's how they track information leaks. So Bob Lazar, a lot of times, will just say, you know, this is what I read, but who knows if it's true? Who knows if it was true or who knows if it was intentionally misleading? I don't know, but that's what it said. So speaking and staying on the element 115 thing, there are a few claims by Bob himself and by George Knapp that he actually stole an amount of element 115 from Area 51 before he was fired. And he took that element 115 home, and before he hid it away, he might have done a couple tests with it, but essentially now it's hidden away, as the story goes. And in maybe uncoincidentally, but maybe coincidentally, Lazar's laboratory and his place of business was raided recently by the FBI, and they cited an ongoing investigation where one of his customers may have used chemicals that was purchased from the chemical supply company for nefarious purposes. But Lazar claims that all of this could have been solved with just a simple phone call. Why did they have to go through this huge ordeal of an entire raid on the place of business? So is it possible that they were searching for this stolen element 115? Again, we'll go into some more proof that perhaps he was telling the truth, and I say proof with quotes here, because similar to the how did he know about when the test flights were scheduled, there are other things that he shouldn't have known, that, but now looking back, it's like, how would he have known that besides the fact that he had to have worked at S4, like he says? And one of these things is hand scanners. So he says in many of his stories that the security to get into the facility of S4 involved a hand scanner where you would put your hand onto a metal plate and it would like biometrically measure the bone length in your hands, which is apparently unique for everybody. And that would grant you clearance into a door or something. And he would talk about this all the time, but the world around him had no idea what he was talking about. That's not known to any of us. That's not a device that anyone knows about or has any photos of or anything like that. And actually very recently in that Netflix documentary, the person who created the documentary actually found photographs from articles and reports that were released by the government from the nearby Nellis Air Force Range, where there were some photographs in there that contained exactly what he was describing all these years, this hand scanner. And I'll post these photos on my social media, but these hand scanners that you would put your hand in and it would measure your bone length. And it's exactly what he was talking about. And only very recently have these photos surfaced to prove that, yeah, these actually exist in government facilities. So how else would he have known about that? Secondly, there are certain names of people that it's hard trying to come up with an explanation as to how he knew these names without actually going through the process of working at S4. For instance, he references a man by the name of Mike Thigpen, who he claimed helped with security clearance at S4. And years later, it would turn out that yes, Thigpen is a real person who did indeed work at Groom Lake for the Office of Federal Investigation that handles security clearance and background checks. So maybe that's another proof, is like, how would he have known that name? So here's another counterpoint that skeptics like to throw in. He is undoubtedly a very sketchy dude, questionable character. And let me go into that. And it's no secret, his personal life has had some questionable moments. In 1990, Lazar was arrested for aiding and abetting an illegal prostitution ring, which the charge was eventually reduced to pandering, but he was found guilty. And around this time, he also declared bankruptcy, a filing for which he listed his occupation as self-employed film processor, which is a curious title for your self-employment for someone who has reportedly been working on theoretical physics in the nation's top laboratories. Also, his recent ownership of that United Nuclear Scientific Equipment and Supplies Company, it's also gotten him into some hot water on more than one occasion, as he's been found out of protocol with his distribution of some of these sometimes dangerous chemicals and supplies. Many skeptics like to point out his questionable character as an indication that it would not be below him to lie for fame. But then maybe there's these believers that want to rebuttal and say, okay, maybe he is sketchy, but for the amount of fame that he could have gained, it sure does seem like he likes to keep to himself and really doesn't enjoy the limelight. And for the most part, that's true. Bob Lazar, on any given day, does not want to talk about Area 51 or his past or any of his claims. And he spent many of the last 30 years in a kind of hiding where he's just kind of living his life and going about his own way and trying to avoid all questions about anything about his past. And when he was asked if he could go back and change anything, he says that he never would have blown the whistle in the first place, and that for the most part, he regrets his actions because they have had a overall negative impact on his life. So we'll get into one other big point that is probably one of the hinges of a skeptic's evidence as to why he is lying. And that is his education. His controversial education remains one of the most heated pieces of the story. Again, there is no record of Bob Lazar ever attending any kind of graduate school, publishing a thesis, or contributing to any kind of other scientific study. The only concrete record that we have of of his education is his enrollment at Los Angeles Pierce College, which again is a community college, for some electronic courses. And furthermore, there are no official records of him ever actually working at Los Alamos either. So how could a man with very little education and experience secure a job at Area 51? It's impossible, right? If his education is a question, if he never actually secured these degrees, his credibility is just out the window. A well-established professor by the name of Dr. David L. Morgan actually published an extensive and comprehensive critique of Bob Lazar's knowledge when it comes to physics, and he was looking at certain things that Bob Lazar claims and how he talks about the scientific field, and he points out that there's a lot of vague claims, and sometimes there's just downright false assertions by Mr. Lazar that he made in the past when it comes to physics. And is this evidence that he is lacking education? Perhaps. However, I personally have to insert here, we have a newspaper clipping actually that refers to Lazar by his name and then further refers to him as a physicist at Los Alamos. And again, it's that newspaper clipping of him hooking up that jet engine to his car. So why would why would the newspaper lie to people? This is before the story broke, right? He is said to be a physicist at Los Alamos. But again, that doesn't necessarily prove that he worked there. Maybe someone got something wrong. But there are several people who were co-workers with Bob Lazar at Los Alamos that have vouched for him and say that they distinctly remember him working there. Furthermore, Lazar has since returned to Los Alamos and actually personally gave George Knapp a tour of the facility, like pointing out things like, oh, over there's that. And it's knowledge that he could only reasonably possess if he had worked there. And I have to ask, if it is true that Bob Lazar worked at the prestigious Los Alamos laboratories, how in the world would they have hired him if he only took some electronic courses at a community college? A job like that, a classified job at Los Alamos and then a subsequent classified job at Area 51 in his 20s, how would he get these jobs without some extensive education? Education that many believers want to say has been erased from the record books by the government to deny Lazar of his credibility. To add even more evidence to this, there are actually photographs of a phone book for the Los Alamos lab from 1982 that lists Lazar as an employee. So I have to continue. I mean, if it is credibility, like if he really does have credibility, if he really does have all this education, why are there no records of it? And the only logical explanation is that they've been erased somehow. And we do definitively know that the government has lied to us before and kept things under wraps when it comes to UFOs and UFO research. And I speak mainly about the recently revealed Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, or ATIP. It's a program that maybe you guys have heard of. It's just very recent news, actually. In 2017, the United States government came out and said, hey, we have had this program running for quite a long time now, and we're just now officially publicly announcing it. And so we know for a long time that they have been lying to us about it, and therefore, we have the knowledge that they have the capacity to lie to us. So is it possible that they're also lying in this scenario? George Knapp is arguably one of the most influential players in this story. Again, he's the one that Bob Lazar initially broke the story to. And he's actually quoted in an interview saying that if it was just Bob Lazar that came forward, if it was just Bob, he would not have pursued the story further, and even to this day in some respects, because Bob Lazar, again, has this questionable background, this questionable credibility. But it wasn't just Bob Lazar. There are many people that have come forward and spoke with Knapp, and said exactly what Lazar had been saying, exactly corroborating his story. And many of these people don't have questionable backgrounds. And so this is what made Knapp just continue with the story. Some of these include U.S. senators, members of the FBI, and furthermore. But this further begs the question, why are there not more ex-Area 51 employees coming forward? I mean, they see that Bob Lazar has come forward with all this information, and if it's true, they see that he's also living with impunity. The government hasn't touched him. He's fine. He's living his life, and even more so, he's living with a little bit of fame, and maybe he's made some money off of this whole thing. So if people who have worked at Area 51 and saw what Bob saw, why aren't they coming forward too? And that's a good question, but the possible answer to this question is one of the most perplexing and dark considerations of this entire case. Seemingly, at every corner and at every impasse, the government men in black suits are there to shut down any inquiry into Bob Lazar and his credibility. While George Knapp was actively investigating the validity of Bob Lazar's claims, he reached out to several individuals and organizations who would have had answers. One individual, a tax preparer by the name of Roy Byram, spoke on the phone with Knapp about setting up an interview to corroborate Lazar's employment at S4, only to immediately be visited at his residence by two men claiming to be from the Secret Service, informing him of the consequences of treason and espionage, actually threatening him with imprisonment as well if he didn't keep his mouth shut. He never came forward to give his story. An electrical engineer who once completed a job at Area 51 spoke on the phone with Knapp about accidentally stumbling upon something he wasn't supposed to see while he was there, something that would further prove Lazar's story. He was promptly followed and intimidated by two military-type men in a car for weeks thereafter. He never came forward to give his story. An official request for employment records on Bob Lazar was launched in the office of Nevada Representative Jim Bilbray, a request that was stonewalled by several government agencies in a manner that was never before seen by Mr. Bilbray. This information also never saw the light of day. A senator from Nevada, Mr. Howard Cannon, also spoke with Knapp on several occasions, giving bits and pieces that supported Bob's claims, but Mr. Cannon passed away at the age of 90 before he could fit in the final pieces of the puzzle. Years later, George Knapp was approached by two men who had worked for the U.S. government and admitted that they were tasked with following and monitoring him, Lazar, Lear, and Huff during the height of the frenzy. So the question I want to leave you with is this. If Bob Lazar truly is a hoaxer, and he knows nothing about Area 51, like the government claims, then why, oh why, is the government so hell-bent on covering it all up? When it comes to my personal beliefs, I subscribe to more of the believer side of things in that I do believe that Bob Lazar, at one point in his life, did work at Area 51 in some capacity, and that's honestly the only way for me that it explains how he knew what he knew. And in this case, it's really interesting to me. Like I said, I've been following it for a long time. It's really interesting to see people argue back and forth about, you know, the skeptics that don't believe him and the believers that do. They argue back and forth about things. And to me, really, the only thing that can match a believer's fervor when it comes to this case and a believer's willingness to believe anything, the only thing that matches that is a skeptic's willingness to deny everything. Honestly, there are some things in this case that you can't just pass over. And again, there are some things in this case that people are just making outlandish jumps in logic. And I think it's more somewhere in the middle is where it really lies. But at any rate, I hope that during this episode, you have come to your own conclusions on Bob Lazar and what you truly believe. And again, if in the future it comes out that at all about anything about what he's saying is true, then it really does change everything about what we know. And everything that he implies, it's just mind-boggling when you really think about it. But at any rate, I do hope that you enjoyed this episode, and I thank you very much for joining me today. All of the sources, all of the pictures that I referenced in today's episode will be posted on my social media. I have a Facebook group that is titled History's Great Mysteries, just like the title of this podcast. And I hope to see you guys on there, see you guys talking about what you guys believe, maybe holes in my theory, holes in other people's theories, and just what you believe about this case. But again, thank you so much for joining me today, and I hope to see you next week on a similar subject, actually, something that might be a continuation of this episode if you are interested in this subject. But I hope to see you next week, like I said, and thank you very much for joining me. Have a great day.